Welcome to BassProRadio.com. Our goal is to keep you informed about the latest information in the growing sport of bass fishing. Every week we will bring you interviews with top pros and industry leaders in this great sport. If you miss any of our shows, you can get caught up on the website at www.bassproradio.com. When you get to the website, be sure and click on the Enter Contest button and fill out the survey. If you know the secret word from this week's show, you'll be entered into a contest to receive a tackle pack valued at over $25. So stay tuned for the secret word later on in this show. On this week's show, we will interview Mike Worm, one of the top pros on the BASS and FLW tours. Mike has won tournaments on both circuits and is one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. Mike will talk about his experience on Lake Champlain in New York and the Red River in Louisiana. We'll be right back with Mike Worm right after a word from our sponsors.
In baseball, it's the finger to the ear, the tug of the nose, the step of the foot. In football, it's the wiggling of the hands, the bending of elbows, the talking in code. In hockey, it's screaming from the bench. Thanks to Verizon Wireless, effective communication in your life doesn't have to be quite as complicated. No matter who you want to call, when you want to call them, or where you want to call them from, Verizon Wireless has great deals on the phone and the calling plan that fits like a glove. Plus, our phones and plans put you on America's most extensive network, giving you the coverage you expect both at home and on the road. Verizon Wireless connects more people in more places across the United States and upstate. Now you can get connected wherever you play. Stop by a Verizon Wireless store today, or for free delivery, call 1-800-2-JOIN-IN. Verizon Wireless, join in.
Hey, would you tie your boat off to a beat-up dock without using a fender or two? And why would you beach your boat without using a Hamby's Protector beaching bumper? If you beach a lot, you need the original 5/8 inch thick Hamby's Protector. These units have been installed on boats for over 14 years and allow worry-free beaching even on rough concrete ramps. If you beach a little, you need the new Hamby's Light Duty model that can be self-installed in about an hour. Don't you hate the sound of your boat going up on a gravel beach? Now with the Hamby's Light Duty, there's no need to worry about what that scratching sound is doing to the resale value of your boat. The new Hamby's Light Duty comes in four colors to match your boat and is made of the same tough urethane as the original. Now you can fish those underdeveloped lakes with overdeveloped bass by loading and unloading your boat without ever getting your feet muddy or wet. Start to enjoy worry-free beaching today by giving Hamby's a call at 1-800-742-2813 or check out the new Hamby's Light Duty by clicking on the website at www.hambys.com.
Boating made easy. That's Jameson Marine.
Remember when you could buy a bass boat with a 150 horsepower outboard motor for under $20,000? Well, you still can at Jameson Marine. There's no catch, an 18-foot, 6-inch Triton with 150 horsepower Mercury, custom drive-on trailer, all for $20,000. Give Jameson Marine a call at 607-527-BOAT and ask about the TR-185 today.
Boating made easy, that's Jameson Marine.
Name your power at Jameson Marine. Triton Bass Boats, Triton Offshore Blue Water, Crest Pontoons, Alumacraft Fishing Boats. We package all the major brands, Mercury, Yamaha, Evinrude, Johnson, Honda, and Jameson Marine, the choice is yours. Take Route 390 South to I-86 East. Jameson Marine is conveniently located at Exit 41, just an hour and a half south of Rochester.
Boating made easy, that's Jameson Marine.
Welcome back to BassProRadio.com. Remember, if you miss any part of this show, you can go to our website at www.bassproradio.com to hear what you missed. Remember to click on the Enter Contest button when you get to the site and fill out the survey that will put you into a drawing for a $25 gift pack. Okay, today we're here with Mike Worm, a BASS and FLW pro from Hot Springs, Arkansas. I was looking at your records a little while ago, Mike, and you had five top tens on the FLW, and you've had two of those this year. That's not a bad year, is it?
No, that's not a bad year at all. That's a great way to start. I think you'll notice both those top tens are also were the first two tournaments, so I kind of jumped out there pretty early and kind of coasted, I think.
How did your year go? Could you start and kind of tell us the tournaments, just real quick summary? And
right. Actually, I had a pretty good year in both circuits this year. In years past, I seem to have a tendency to do well in one or the other, like I do wedding bass and not so well in FLW, or well in FLW and not so well in bass. And But this year it seemed to work out. I did well in both of them, and I had some really good tournaments fairly soon. Like I had a top 10 in the BASS in October, which gets you started off good. And I had those two top 10s in the FLW back-to-back, and that gets you started off well. And when that happens, it kind of calms me down for the rest of the year because I know I've got a good start on making the classics and championships. And so I concentrate more on my fishing and have a much more smoother year, and usually it'd be more consistent.
So it gives you confidence to kind of carry you on.
Absolutely. You start off on a good foot. Same way with this year. The first BASS, was at Lake St. Clair and was 18, so I have got a good start on this year, too.
Super. Okay, well, what we'd like to do today is we'd like to talk about two different bodies of water, one down south and one up north. As you know, we're located in Rochester, New York, and Champlain's about a 4 or 5 hour drive from here. There's a lot of tournaments that are held, even a lot of club tournaments that go over to Lake Champlain. And I know that you guys were all scheduled to go there when the tragedy in New York City happened, but I'd like to hear about what your experience was on that lake and then contrast it to the Red River and the different kinds of cover, the different approach. And what I'd like to do is really start before you even leave home. Tell us about your planning for Lake Champlain, and then when you get done with that, we'll talk about your planning for the Red River and what you do before you even leave the driveway.
Okay, that's not a problem at all. Actually, for Lake Champlain, I started quite a while back. When they announce at the beginning of the year, they announce the schedules, and they usually announce where the championships and classics are. And even at that time, you start thinking about it. You start kind of keeping it in the back of your mind. When you run across somebody from that area or you see something printed about that certain body of water, you kind of, kick your little brain in gear and you read it and talk to those people that are from there. And you start your homework even that early. And you start accumulating things. At least that's what I do. And you keep these little things in the back of your brain, and you kind of call them back when the time comes. Get to about a week or so before I leave to go to Champlain, I start calling on some friends of mine. And one in particular is Terry Baxley, a friend of mine from up there, and he fished it a lot more than I have. So he was not in the tournament, so I called and asked him, and he gave me some few ideas. And I've been up there a couple of times already, so I kind of knew in my mind what I was going to do and what I was going to look for. And it's a huge body of water. And the first thing I want to do on that body of water is knock it down to size. Because there's no way that I can fish that whole lake. I mean, we're looking at a 100-mile-long lake or so, and there's no way you're going to fish at all.
Right.
So I'm going on my past experiences up there, those other BASS tournaments that we've had, and the areas I fished and was successful. And then I try some other areas that Terry may have given me on maps or just something off the top of his head or something I might have read or seen otherwise and kind of tie it all together. And I have the charts and everything, so I'll go up there, and I've already got a game plan more or less even before I go. And so after I get there, the first thing I do on Champlain, that body of water, when the first day I get out there, well, another thing I do before I start is I look at the weather, because the weather is a big factor on Champlain, especially the wind. And you check the wind out, and you want to know where it's going to come from, because that will inhibit you to some extent on where you can fish on Champlain.
North-south impede you doing a long run type of thing? Or?
Exactly. And see, we're putting in at Mooney Bay, which is on the west side, in the New York side.
Right.
So a south wind is going to be really interesting over there. So if you get a south wind forecast, you're going to have to make adjustments. But the first day I get out there, I just want to see what's going on. In other words, what the water level is, what the water clarity is, what the water temperature is, and just kind of get a feel for the place and go check some of the shallow water areas and see what the grass is like, the underwater grass and the submergent and the emergent grass. But, kind of check them out and see what they're like, because, you have a largemouth and a smallmouth population there, and either one of them can win a tournament for you.
Right.
So you have to kind of focus on that. And, first half a day, I'm just kind of looking, more or less, and just getting a feel for the place and kind of see if there's a quick bite or if there's a quick pattern, quick shallow pattern, And in this case, this year, there really wasn't. Most of the smallmouth were hinging on the deeper side, and it took a day or two to figure that out. But you just kind of do it by, just like you would any other tournament, by, if this works, great. If it don't work, we try something else. And if something else works, you find another place on the chart that looks just like it, or you know a place that looks just like it, and you go try that.
Now, did you have your milk run or your plan before you launched your boat as
sure
to where
did.
You
I
were
going
to go?
I knew where I was going before I even launched the boat. I knew the areas where I was going to, and I knew I was going to check out Mallet's Bay as soon as I could, but now the wind was blowing up there. It blew 2 days before I know. And you couldn't get to it. And the water was low. I found that out the first day, so I couldn't go under the little sand bridge to get into Mallet's Bay. So you had to drive all the way down there by car unless you wanted to really pound yourself by boat.
Right.
You know? So, but one day it wasn't so bad, and I got to go down there by boat, and I ruled it out because they weren't biting. I couldn't give them the bite down there like I like to bite, like to catch them down there. So I completely ruled out that whole area and just moved north. And then I checked out my other areas that I had found, and I found a pattern going on, and on the rocks and on the deeper rocks on certain points and lee sides of the islands, and then also on certain underwater humps out in there. And from that, I found at least 10 places where I felt like I could probably catch a limit of fish off of each place.
Was there a lot of distance between these places, or were they fairly close together?
They were fairly close together. Most all of them were there in the inland sea. And the reason that was, I checked mainly on the inland sea because the wind was blowing out of the south. Well, the wind on the inland sea is rough, but you can still get around and fish a lot of areas because you have a lot of those islands knocking the wind off.
Right.
So in my mind, since we could not go into Canada, that was not going to be possible in this tournament. They weren't going to let you go into Canada. The inland sea was probably going to be where it was won. Since the Mallet Bay fish didn't kick on for me and they weren't biting in that area, we're going to have a strong south wind out there. I figured Mallet, the inland sea was the place to be, and so that's where I concentrated my efforts. And I found a great smallmouth pattern out there on Carolina rigs and also on spinnerbaits. And then I had another pattern on largemouth. I found some grass beds that they were holding in grass beds around, 3 to 6 feet deep in around these humps of milfoil and hydrilla, and I could catch them on a jig. So I had two good patterns going. I was real confident, but, most everybody was confident those little fish were biting.
Now, you said you were fishing the Carolina rig. You were fishing smallies on a Carolina rig?
Right. I was catching smallmouth. When they were up early, you could catch them on spinnerbait pretty well, just ripping a spinnerbait right below the surface about a foot and a half, 2 foot. Chartreuse spinnerbait, chartreuse blades, you could get some action there, but you wouldn't catch many. But you could go back to that same area as over these rock points that drop off into deep water and throw a Carolina rig with a green pumpkin lizard. And green pumpkin lizard was definitely the best choice here. I tried worms, I tried finesse baits, I tried centipedes, but the green pumpkin lizard was definitely the best. And I determined that on a certain point, and I caught some deep, and then I looked on the map on the chart, and I found two or three underwater humps here, and I went to check them. And one of them had a tremendous school of fish on it. I just couldn't believe it. And you could sit there and catch them until you just got tired of it. It was just 2 to 5 pounders, just regular. So that was a real strong place I had there. And then I found another place that had a great school of fish on it. And then I went largemouth fishing and found these largemouths and these grass beds. So I felt pretty confident going into the tournament.
Well, two questions on that. First is, you're in practice and you're finding these fish. How bad do you tear them up? How many did you catch before you decided you had had enough and you knew what you wanted there?
Well, I don't bother too much with worry about catching fish until the day before the tournament. 2 days before, 3 days before, I have some fun. I catch quite a few fish. The day before, I don't catch very many at all. The day before, I might check a place and get one bite, and leave, and I'm like, another bite, another place to get one more bite and leave. The day before the tournament, I don't like to catch them, but the 2 days before, 3 days before, it doesn't bother me so bad. So I would catch, 5 or 6, 8 off of a place just to check the size. I'm not really wanting to check the vast numbers. I want to check the size. But so many times I hear people talk about when I'm giving seminars, they'll do something in practice. They'll find some fish and say, man, I went down this bank the day before the tournament. I got 15 bites that didn't catch anything, okay? If you don't catch anything, they could all be 10 inches. I mean, you've got to catch one or two just to make sure that these are the kind of quality fish you want.
Right.
So you have to catch a few of them just to see what size they are. But, no, you don't want to sit there and pound them.
Now, if I can ask you a quick question on a Carolina rig, I know for myself it's not one of my strong ways to fish. And one of the reasons I feel unconfident with it is I don't know how the bait really feels. As I drag it along and I feel like that worm's just bouncing around, I think that's what makes it a great bait. But I never feel any really good strikes. It's not like a jig and pig or a Texas rig or even a finesse type of deal where you really feel that tick. How do you know when you got a fish on a Carolina rig? Most of the Yankee Club folks around here are all jig and pig or finesse fishermen. They're not doing the Carolina rig.
Sure. The reason you feel that bite so well with a Texas rig is because your line is directly to the lure itself. You don't have any slack in it, and you can feel it a little better as far as bite. But that also hinges or restricts the movement of that lure as far as action, because it's tied right to the line. So every time you move that rod, that lure is going to jump. Well, the beauty part of a Carolina rig is that the lure has such a subtle motion to it that it's not completely restricted by your line tied right to it. It has a real subtle motion. But with the sinker being on the bottom, and that's the key to Carolina rigging, is you have to keep that sinker in contact with the bottom at all times. That's the best part for Carolina rigging. and it will do a lot of things for you, and I'll get to that later. But as far as the bite is concerned, remember that the lure is not moving that fast. It's just floating along. So the fish is not going to usually hit it with a viciousness. In other words, they're not going to hit it with a viciousness that they have to catch it to kill it. They're just going to come up and inhale it. And if you have some slack, you have a 2 to 3 foot leader, you're going to have a little slack line there, so you're not going to feel a real thump. What you're going to feel, though, is a pressure. You're going to feel a pressure of that thing moving. You might pull it up, and it doesn't want to come. And a lot of people will say, well, it feels like it's got a leaf on it, it's got something or slime on it, and that's probably a bite. And so the best thing to do is when you get that pressure, just pull your line tight and just hold it. And the fish not going to sit still. They're not just going to sit there. You'll feel it move. They'll either pulse or it'll start smoothing, just pulling down, you know, or it might tick a little bit. I've had them bite it several different ways, and smallmouth are really fastidious on this. When they're really feeding, though, they'll swallow the thing. And you have to really pay attention and hook them fairly quickly. You'll get a lot of swallows. If they're not feeding real good, they'll just tick at it and tick at it and tick at it, and then they'll finally get it. But that's what you need to do, is just pull that line tight and just sit there and hold it, and you'll feel him move very slowly somewhere.
The next question on the Carolina rig is weed fishing. I don't know if you fished a lot of reeds when you were in Champlain or not, but a lot of the natural lakes up here are just full of these milfoil beds that are, you know, 2 and 3 and 5 acres big. Uh-huh. Do you fish a Carolina rig through that real thick milfoil stuff, or do you fish the outside edges with it?
You might fish some outside edges with it, but it's not really a dense cover technique. You know, I really don't fish it in that. The only time I might fish in that, I fish it sometimes in Florida, I'll short my leader up to like a foot, 16 inches to a foot, something like that, and pull a lightweight, like a 3/8 ounce, that sits on top of that grass and work it on top of that grass. But as far as trying to get that half ounce and 1 ounce sinker down in that stuff, it just doesn't work. All the time you're pulling it through there, and you'll miss a lot more fish than you'll catch, even if you get the bites. Sometimes it is effective, though, on the outside edge of that, especially if there's a drop-off close by. If you can get that thing to work right along the outside edge of that grass bed, you present that lure to the fish in a different manner, because it's always in their strike zone versus a drop bait or a jig or a worm that just falls through the zone.
Well, did you find any largemouth when you were on Champlain?
You know, one thing about Champlain, I fished two tournaments up there, and both of them, the largemouth played a major factor. You know, I had these largemouth found in some weeds, just like you were describing, a big weed bed out of a hydrilla milfoil. And they were holding close to the clumps, and you'd have to put that jig or tube, you know, I use a Strike King tube also, around these clumps and into the clumps, and you would get these bites as it fell down through there. What the beauty part of those largemouths up there is I don't think they get the attention that the smallmouths get. And if you can ever find a concentration of the largemouth, sometimes you can really catch a huge string. You can catch 20 to 22 pounds up there in largemouth if you can find an area where they're kind of holding. And that will turn the tide, because it's a little harder to catch a 20-pound bag of smallmouth up there. So largemouths are definitely something to target. Some of the better largemouth areas probably up in the Canadian, up in the Missisquoi, up in that area. But there's also some good largemouths down in Mallets when it's on fire, and also up in St. Albans.
Well, you've got these big milfoil beds. How do you find the sweet spot of a big milfoil bed when you're out there practicing and you've got a limited amount of time?
Right.
And these things are huge. What do you do to shorten that up?
The first thing I want to do to shorten it up is I'm going to check the depth. You know, how deep is it on the outside edge where it first starts? How shallow does it get toward the bank or in the middle of the bed? So the fish are usually going to be in that middle part where it's the shallow, or if they're going to be closer to the edge. If they're scattered just at random out through there, it takes a while. But if you can ever pinpoint how they're really holding, are they holding inside the little pods of grass, or are they holding in the clear places between the pods of grass? That's another thing you need to figure out. So the first thing I do is I go in there, I do the shallowest part of the thing I can find first, just to see if they're shallow. Usually if they're up in the shallow part, they're feeding more actively, and they're going to be hitting a little bit more aggressively. So that makes it easy. But if they're not there, then you start working your way out toward the edge. And once you find that little stretch where they're concentrating on, it's usually going to be a certain depth range. Then you need to find out in that depth range, aren't they in the pods themselves, or are they sitting to the side of it? And that way you can kind of eliminate the rest of it. After you get that little pattern going, you can eliminate the other parts.
Do you just kind of pick a slot in the middle and try and check it from the shallow to the deep end, or do you... Okay, so you just pick one end and determine whether they're there, and if they're there, then you work the bigger part of the bed?
Exactly.
Okay, cool.
Well, you know, once you kind of locate the depth and the exact way they're holding in those pods of grass, then you can go from there.
Okay, we need to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about what you did before you left home to go to the Red River.
All right.
In baseball, It's the finger to the ear, the tug of the nose, the step of the foot. In football, it's the wiggling of the hands, the bending of elbows, the talking in code. In hockey, it's screaming from the bench. Thanks to Verizon Wireless, effective communication in your life doesn't have to be quite as complicated. No matter who you want to call, when you want to call them, or where you want to call them from, Verizon Wireless has great deals on the phone and the calling plan that fits like a glove. Plus, our phones and plans put you on America's most extensive network, giving you the coverage you expect both at home and on the road. Verizon Wireless connects more people in more places across the United States and upstate. Now you can get connected wherever you play. Stop by a Verizon Wireless store today, or for free delivery, call 1-800-2-JOIN-IN. Verizon Wireless, join in.
Hey, would you tie your boat off to a beat-up dock without using a fender or two? Then why would you beach your boat without using a Hamby's Protector beaching bumper? If you beach a lot, you need the original 5/8 inch thick Hamby's Protector. These units have been installed on boats for over 14 years and allow worry-free beaching even on rough concrete ramps. If you beach a little, you need the new Hamby's Light Duty model that can be self-installed in about an hour. Don't you hate the sound of your boat going up on a gravel beach? Now with the Hamby's Light Duty, there's no need to worry about what that scratching sound is doing to the resale value of your boat. The new Hamby's Light Duty comes in four colors to match your boat and is made of the same tough urethane as the original. Now you can fish those underdeveloped lakes with overdeveloped bass by loading and unloading your boat without ever getting your feet muddy or wet. Start to enjoy worry-free beaching today by giving Hamby's a call at 1-800-742-2813 or check out the new Hamby's Light Duty by clicking on the website at www.hambys.com. At Jamison Marine, we carry Triton bass boats, the world's number one selling bass boat. Tritons come with a 100% composite hull warranty. No wood to rot. Triton was also the first to offer a lifetime warranty on their hull, and it's the best riding bass boat in the country. Stop in and see the new 2002 Tritons at Jamison Marine. Take I-390 south to I-86. Jamison is located right at exit 41, just an hour and a half south of Rochester.
Boating made easy, that's Jamison Marine.
Welcome back to BassProRadio.com. Remember, if you miss any of this show, you can go to our website at www.bassproradio.com to hear what you missed. Remember to click on the Enter Contest button when you get to the site and fill out the survey. If you know the secret word for this week's show, which is topwater, it'll put you into a drawing for a $25 tackle pack. Okay, we're back again with Mike Worm, the touring pro from the FLW and BASS. Mike, let's take and shift our focus now down south to the Red River and kind of tell us what you did there before you left home, then your first day of practice, and how you made adjustments, what you learned in your first day of practice that set you up for your second day of practice, that kind of stuff.
All right. Well, number one, the Red River is a totally different kind of water system than Lake Champlain. I mean, it's about as different as you can get. You know, number one, they don't have any smallmouth, so that takes that out of the factors completely. But they do have a lot of spots in that river, and they have a lot of largemouth. But the Red River gets its name from being just what it is, red. And a lot of times during the year, it's just red mud. And they got a big rain in the area, and also the area over in Oklahoma where the Red River comes from, and about, 3 weeks ago. And it was still had a lot of leftover from that rain. But before I went down there, they had a Redmond Regional the week before our tournament, I believe, or maybe 2 weeks before. I knew some guys that were in that tournament. So once again, I talked to some friends of mine around that went down there. And to see what they were, you know, what the water was like and everything. I got to kind of a feel about what to expect. And I knew the water was high then, but it would be down to normal when I got down there. So I did a little homework there, and I got my maps out. I started looking where the areas I wanted to go first and what the fish should be doing. And in that situation, there's a lot of backwater on that river. And the backwaters are important because they got a lot of cover in those backwaters. There's a lot of standing timber. And what they are oxbows in some cases they're just fields that have been inundated when the river was made navigable by those dams and locks, and they just left the trees in them. But what you need to do on that situation, you need to key in on clearer water. And to get that clearer water, you need to find some areas that was away from the main river current. In other words, where the muddy water couldn't intrude on it. And those fish, not that the fish wouldn't necessarily migrate to those areas, but they would definitely bite better in those areas. So that's what I tried to do when I looked at my maps, was find some areas that I wanted to go to and practice to see if that water was any clearer back in there. And, you know, you have to be innovative in those situations and try to find a way back to those areas. So sometimes it's really tricky to find a little openings to get in there to them. And that's part of the fishing on Red Rivers and rivers in general that have a lot of backwaters, is finding the ways to them. Mississippi Rivers, it's some ways the same situation, the lower Mississippi down there around Memphis. It's a much bigger river than the Red River, but you treat it kind of the same because you try to find these backwater areas, the oxbows and things. And getting into them sometimes is kind of exciting. I mean, you have to either move rocks or bend trees, or, you know, and it's just get you a push pole and then hope you can get in there and then hope you can get out.
Do you carry a chainsaw? I know that some guys do. I was just curious if you
did. And some guys do. In practice, you can do that. You can't do that in a tournament. You know, in tournament, the rules say you can get out of your boat to push yourself out of a place, but you can't do that to get in a place. In other words, you can't get that outside help to get in anywhere, but you can to get out. So to get in, you just have to hope you can get in there on a big motor or a push pole or your trolling motor. You know, you can't get out and push. So that's part of tournament fishing. But that's what I did to get ready to go down there. And then after I got there, of course, the first thing you do, you look at the water, just how muddy is it. And it was muddy. And then after that, I thought, well, I know what I need to do. I need to find these clear water areas. And then you've got three pools of fish. You know, you got the lock and dams between each pool. And you can lock down and get in these other pools. Well, the farther down you go, the less people you're going to have. In other words, the farther away on that river, the less people you're going to have to fish around. So it's more or less, if you can find some fish that far away, you'll more or less have them, not to yourself, but you won't have to spread them around with too many other people. But the risk you take in doing that is you have to run through two locks and then run that river between them. So you've got a lot of time wasted. In practice, though, I didn't have to do that. In practice, you drive my car and go put in a ramp down there closer to where you're wanting to fish and save a lot of that time. So the first day of practice, I rolled way down the river and put in down there and fished some of those backwaters, and I found some fish down there. Not a whole lot, but I had a little bit of promises going on. I was getting these backwater areas, and there was shad prevalent, and I was throwing a small Strike King Series 3 crankbaits and spinnerbaits, Strike King spinnerbaits, and catching a few fish that way. I tried some Carolina rigging here and there, and it did to no avail. And so I said, okay, I got this. Now I need to go stay up river a day just to eliminate. I mean, you hate to miss something there close just because you weren't, you know, just didn't take the time to check it out. So the next day I put in right there at the marina where we start, which is not, in this situation on the Red River at Clark's Marina, is not a bad idea, because Clark's Marina is only just about the only marina on the whole river. So all the tournaments on that river are held at Clark's Marina. Well, there's a lot of fish released at Clark's Marina. And they don't go far. They'll go up and down the bank there, and there's standing timber all around, and then there's little chutes out to the main river channel, so there's always fish around Clark's. The last tournament we had there at the Red River was an FLW tournament last spring, I believe, or late spring. And I did well in that tournament right there by Clark's Marina. So I checked out that area, and the water was really dark, and I got like three bites in there all day. I just, you know, more or less ruled it out in my mind. A lot of my practice is not really finding fish. It's eliminating water. You know, a lot of times you'll say on a practice day, people ask you if you caught anything, and you say, well, that didn't do any good. They say, well, I'm sorry to hear that. But in some instances, that could be really helpful to you because you've eliminated a lot of water. It'll make you concentrate more on the areas when you do get a bite. So, you know, then you don't have to worry about going to the other areas because you've eliminated it and you made that body of water a lot smaller and you can concentrate on a smaller area.
Well, can I back you up just a little bit as far as maps go? Because you mentioned that you got out your maps and you were looking. Do you get out multiple types of maps, or what kind of maps do you look for when you're going out to buy one? You've got, you know, fishing hotspots that's got maps of all the really big waters around anymore. Do those have enough detail for you? Do you go after navigation maps? What's your favorite kind of map to look at?
So it depends on the body of water. You know, in some bodies of water just have a restricted number of maps on them at all. The Red River doesn't have very many maps on it yet. So, you know, but there's some bodies of water that really require a good chart. And, you know, all your northern lakes up there seem to have good charts. I think that's because of the northernness, of course, it's the size of Champlain and Ontario and Detroit, you know, St. Clair, they've got great charts of those, and that you can rely on those charts. Every little hump's on it, and every little, you know, curve is on it, every little anything is on those charts. But when you go down south in some of these impoundments, sometimes the maps you get, they does not include everything there. And so you might rely more on feel, right, more or less, and on your on your contacts where things are. Most of the time, though, I try to use a map maybe in practice, but most of the time when it comes tournament, I throw the maps away. I mean, I should know what I'm doing by then. I shouldn't have to take the time to look at maps because I should know where I'm going and what I'm going to do. I think some guys might waste too much time watching maps, looking at maps and watching their GPS, the charts and everything during tournament days. And, you know, you need to do that in practice and get all that done in practice so that when it comes tournament time, you just go fish. You know where you're going, you know what you're going to do. Most of my map work is done before the tournament and at first or second practice day, and then after that, the maps usually go in the box.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, getting back to the Red River, a friend of mine fished down there in the Federation tournament that Mike Iaconelli won, and he said you look in any direction for as far as you can see, and there's nothing but wood.
There's some areas like that.
And I've fished like areas like Rodman are the same kind of way. And if it all looks good, then what do you look for?
Well, down there, when the water's muddy, I want to try to find an area in those backwater trees. And you got to remember, these trees are also probably 6 to 8 foot deep. I want to find the water that's a little bit different color, a little bit clearer, got just a little bit more clarity to it. And also, what those fish tend to do in an area with trees like that, they'll tend to gather around either a certain kind of tree, say a hardwood versus a pine. Or they'll tend to gather around just certain trees in that stand. In other words, one big tree that might have a little slant to it. Or here's a tree over here that's got three or four little bush, you know, little limb-like things around the base of it. And once you can find one of those, you know, kind of mother trees, then you're going to find it. When you catch a fish, you really need to pay close attention when you're in that situation, because I almost guarantee you there'll be another one around close by. And then once you find that kind of little pattern, then you might try to search out another tree just like it. But many times I fish in trees and stand in timber like that where they will focus, or the fish will tend to focus on a certain type of tree, like a little group of hardwoods and a stand of pines, or something like that in that situation. And that's, you know, you just, observation in fishing is absolutely critical. Anytime you're fishing, you need to be completely observant of everything that's going on around you. Everything that's going on in the air as well as in the water. What the surroundings are, what the birds are doing, what the water's doing, what the wind's doing. You need to be observant of all these things all the time. And then when you catch that fish, you need to just immediately, your brain needs to key in exactly what's happening at the time that fish bites. How deep was he? What kind of tree was he around? Was the wind blowing against it? Was it in the shade? Was it in the sun? And then you can try to duplicate that. And if you can duplicate it and catch another one, you're really on to something. Then you can kind of go to town. But I can't say enough, and all of the seminars I present, I can't explain enough that you need to be so observant of everything that's happening all the time.
Well, in an area like this where all the wood looks similar and you find this kind of trees, do you have a search bait versus a column bait? What's your choices there?
Search bait I usually try to use is a spinner bait or a crank bait. I mean, that you can cover a lot of area in a short period of time. You know, a lot of guys say, well, crankbait, how can you throw crankbaits in that kind of situation? Well, crankbait is not a problem in that kind of situation. You can throw a crankbait around those trees, and it gets hung up very seldom. And most of the time, you know, if you don't throw, you're not going to throw a damn 15 or 20-plus crankbait in something like that. You're going to throw something you can reach with the rod tip. So when it does get hung up, you can just go over there and get unhung. But it's a great search bait, especially when you're firing on your shad, you know. You don't have to reel it slow to get it down. You can still reel it fairly quick. Not like, you know, on a spinner bait, you got to really slow it down if you want it to sink a little bit. Crank bait, you just throw it in there and keep going. And Strike King's got a great series of crankbaits for this, and I really love them. They've got the Series 4S, which is a full-body crankbait with a square lip, has a good wide wobble and a great rattle, and I've caught a lot of fish on that in the timber and laydowns. That's my favorite crankbait for that, without a doubt. And if it gets hung up, it's not a problem. It's only down there a couple of feet. I just, you know, I can get over there and pop it loose without any problem, but it's a great search bait. And it's also a tremendous big fish bait in that situation. They think it's a big shad or a brim comes by that log, boom, they're on it. And, you know, and they don't see that as often as they see, say, a plastic worm in a jig or a spinner bait. They don't see those crankbaits as often. You know, and there's a lot of guys that fish it like that. Rick Klunz is a big fisherman of crankbait and timber like that. He fishes it all the time. But that's what I was using at that Red River, and that's what I caught my fish on, the Strike King Series 3 and a spinner bait. That was the two things. I couldn't get a flipping bite going. I tried a jig and a tube, and you know, I got a bite or two, but it would take forever. And the problem where I was fishing, I wound up going way down the river. going through two locks, and it would take me 2 hours to get where I wanted to fish. And after I got there, I only had about 3 hours and 45 minutes to fish, and I had to come back. So I had to do something quick. I mean, I didn't have enough time. If something didn't work, I didn't have much adjustment time. So I had to really concentrate on the cover and fishing. I was fishing and the lure.
So in this tournament, you caught your fish on your search bait. You didn't switch up or try and really pinpoint the trees that had fish on it, or did you double up on those trees after you catch one on it?
After I catch, what happened down there is the fish were starting to school in these backwaters. And then I found a little area that was school, but there's a school of fish in it. And I could throw that crankbait in that same area over and over and over and get a different angle, throw it in there, and get a different angle, throw it in there again. And that's how I caught my fish the first day. The second day, they didn't bite as well, and I had to adjust. So I had another area where they were hitting shad pretty well on spinnerbait. So I'll go in there and I catch a couple on crankbait, put the crankbait down, pick the spinnerbait up, and fish it much like I would flipping a jig or a tube. Because I would throw it around these same bushes and trees, but I'd throw it really slower than I would the crankbait and present a different situation to the fish and present a slower presentation. And it paid off really well. The last day I caught a nice lemon on the spinnerbait.
Okay, we've got to take another break. When we come back, I'd like to talk to you about the adjustments that you made and why you made them. And then if we've got a little time left, we'll talk about the business of bass fishing.
Great.
So we'll be right back.
In baseball, it's the finger to the ear, the tug of the nose, the step of the foot. In football, it's the wiggling of the hands, the bending of elbows, the talking in code. In hockey, it's screaming from the bench. Thanks to Verizon Wireless, effective communication in your life doesn't have to be quite as complicated. No matter who you want to call, when you want to call them, or where you want to call them from, Verizon Wireless has great deals on the phone and the calling plan that fits like a glove. Plus, our phones and plans put you on America's most extensive network, giving you the coverage you expect both at home and on the road. Verizon Wireless connects more people in more places across the United States and upstate. Now you can get connected wherever you play. Stop by a Verizon Wireless store today, or for free delivery, call 1-800-2-JOIN-IN. Verizon Wireless, join in.
Hey, would you tie your boat off to a beat-up dock without using a fender or two? Then why would you beach your boat without using a Hamby's Protector beaching bumper? If you beach a lot, you need the original 5/8 inch thick Hamby's Protector. These units have been installed on boats for over 14 years and allow worry-free beaching even on rough concrete ramps. If you beach a little, you need the new Hamby's Light Duty model that can be self-installed in about an hour. Don't you hate the sound of your boat going up on a gravel beach? Now with the Hamby's Light Duty, there's no need to worry about what that scratching sound is doing to the resale value of your boat. The new Hamby's Light Duty comes in four colors to match your boat and is made of the same tough urethane as the original. Now you can fish those underdeveloped lakes with overdeveloped bass by loading and unloading your boat without ever getting your feet muddy or wet. Start to enjoy worry-free beaching today by giving Hamby's a call at 1-800-742-2813 or check out the new Hamby's Light Duty by clicking on the website at www.hambys.com.
Boating made easy. That's Jameson Marine. Who gets you ready for fun?
Boating made easy.
For fun on the water, the only one. For boating, the fishing, everything you need is waiting for you at Jameson Marine. Boating made easy. That's Jameson Marine.
Remember when you could buy a bass boat with a 150 horsepower outboard motor for under $20,000? Well, you still can at Jameson Marine. There's no catch, an 18-foot, 6-inch Triton with 150 horsepower Mercury, custom drive-on trailer, all for $20,000. Ask about the new TR-185 today. Remember, we're just an hour and a half southeast of Rochester. Take Route 390 south to Jameson Marine. It's located right at Exit 41 in Campbell.
Boating made easy. That's Jameson Marine.
Welcome back to BassProRadio.com. Remember, if you miss any of this show, you can go to our website at www.bassproradio.com to hear what you missed. Remember to click on the Enter Contest button when you get to the site and fill out the survey. If you know the secret word for this week's show, which is topwater, it'll put you into a drawing for a $25 tackle pack. We're back with Mike Worm from the FLW and BASS Tour. Mike, we were talking a minute ago about, okay, you're done with practice and you're starting into the tournament. And during the break there, we were talking a little bit about the adjustments that people make. And go ahead and tell the folks about what happened during the tournament and how you figured out how to adjust. And what in your mind, is it just time on the water that helps you do that? Or is there some secret that you can let us amateurs in on that'll help us adjust faster?
Yeah, you know, the only answer I can give to that is experience. It's like you said, time on the water. You just can't beat it. A lot of guys now are using journals and or they take notes or they'll put it in a computer disk or whatever. And, you know, every day when they come in, they write all this stuff down, which is a great idea because you can't remember everything. And if you can go back and hit that again and refresh your memory, it'd help a lot. But still, you know, it doesn't help you when you're out there on the water in a situation. You don't have your computer handy. You don't have your logbook with you, so you have to rely on your memory. And a lot of your memory bank's brain will still function for you, even if you get as old as I am. It'll still work. But, you know, during a tournament, you're constantly making decisions. And in the Red River tournament, the water was falling slowly. Every day it would fall a little bit more, and every day the backwaters would clear up a little bit more, and the fish would move. The situation I was in particular, and I know some other friends of mine that were fishing the same kind of pattern were having the same problem. And the fish were in the backs of these backwater areas, in the backs of these little feeder oxbows and creeks, and where the water was clear at the beginning of the tournament. And as the water fell, the fish would come out with it. The fish would leave that shallower water and start moving down out the creek. They would move 200-300 yards during the day, you know, and then after the second day, they wouldn't even be where they started. And you have to adjust in that situation to the fish. You have to go where they are. And what you do is you're not getting any bites here where they must have moved, so you start moving out with them. And once you figured out where they were headed, and the situation, what was happening, it was pretty easy because you could just follow them right on out the creek. And that's what enabled me to catch a nice limit the last day was to find those fish on out farther out in the creek than where they were previously. But in any tournament, you're faced with a number of decisions and choices during a tournament. During a tournament day, even if it's a single-day tournament, you're going to have to choose. And most of the time, the winner's guy makes the right choices and the right decisions at the right time. And the guys that are repetitive winners are guys that are really good at recognizing changes quickly and adjusting to them. And that really comes from just experience, a lot of experience and time on the water. It also comes, though, from paying attention. And using that one element in the boat that's the most underutilized element in most anybody's fishing boat, and that's that lump on top of your shoulders. You know, if you forget to use that brain and forget to pay attention to what's going on around you, you're going to miss some key points, some key clues during the day that would enable you to catch more fish. If you're in tune, you know, you hear Klun talk about being in the zone, and in my opinion, that's what he's talking about. You're in the zone when you're keyed into everything that's going on around you, when you're keyed into what the fish are doing in response to their environment. And, you know, you're going after a creature when you're fishing. You're going after a creature in his environment, not necessarily yours. He's in the water. He's going to be completely dependent on his environment as to his actions. That's what occurs. Whatever happens to his environment is an action in his behalf. And he's going to move accordingly to be comfortable, and he's going to move to eat. So you have to keep in mind and pay attention to everything that changes in his environment so that you can change to go where he is and present your bait in front of him thusly. So, you know, it's just a lot of time on the water, and experience helps more than anything else.
I can buy the time on the water part as far as knowing that you have to change. The hard part then is looking for where you think the fish went.
Exactly.
With respect to a body of water that you don't fish every day. I mean, the Red River, I'm not sure how far away it is from you, but I know it's a decent drive.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know those fish move 200-300 yards? How familiar do you get with the area that you're fishing? Do you understand where the river channel is every time you're fishing up shallow and you know the direction, or you have a pretty good idea in your head where the fish are going to move to if the water does fall or if the water does rise?
Sure. In this situation, you certainly do, because you're in the back of an oxbow. No, it's just like a creek that you go back into the end of it and it's just blocked off, you know, it's cut off in the river. So if the fish are in the back of it and the water starts dropping, they're going to move. They have nowhere else to go but out. They're going to have to go out. They're going to follow that clear water going out. That's where the bait fish are going to be going out, you know, just because they're going to run out of water in the back and won't be able to swim anymore, so they got to go out. So that one was fairly easy. But now if you're talking about out in the middle of the river, in the main river channel or in a lake situation, then you have a much bigger area where they can move, so they're not near as trapped. So you have to a lot more to decide. But in the Red River situation, it was pretty easy to figure that out.
You got any secrets on smallies? Because they always seem to be the ghost fish. Catch them big one day, and the next day they're gone.
smallies. I tell you, that little smallmouth, I try to tell these friends of mine that live down here in Arkansas that never experienced a smallmouth like that. I said, you know, if you go up there one time, you'll call your largemouth trash fish. You know, you know, after you catch a bunch of smallmouth, you hit a largemouth, and you think you just got a big old weed on or something, because it's just nothing like it. And I've taken a couple of guys up there, and after they've been up and caught a bunch of smallmouth, they're just hooked. You know, they can't believe what a deal it is. But a secret to a smallmouth, you know, I don't know. I try to key on their aggressiveness. Most of the time, a smallmouth is going to be more aggressive, and that's, you know, when I go up north and smallmouth fishing, the first thing I'm going to throw at them is a spinnerbait. If you can get them to be aggressive and hit that spinnerbait, you know, you're reeling it quick, about a foot and a half underneath the water. If you can get that bite going, you're going to have some good success. Because what it's going to do, when you're going across a flat or a point or you're throwing that spinnerbait and you get some bites, then you know the fish are there. You know there's a population of fish there, and they're aggressive and they're eating. And after you throw that a while and they might slow down, you know they're still there. That's when you come back with a tube and a Carolina rig or a crankbait. You're going to catch some more. But I kind of try to key on the smallmouth's aggressive nature. And then if you can ever get them turned on, it's automatic.
Yeah, they are a ball to catch. And it seems like the ones that are 14 to 16 inches pull 10 times more than the 6 and 7 pound smallies do. So
it's incredible. They never give up. You get them right by the boat and you think you got them, and that's wrong. You don't have them until you got them in the boat.
That's correct. Okay, I want to try and shift gears here a little bit with a little bit of time we've got left and talk about the business of bass fishing. There's a lot of guys out there. The sport is exploding, and a lot of people want to go out and be a bass pro, and a lot of people think if they win a couple club tournaments, they ought to start looking for sponsorship, and people ought to be knocking on their door because they're really good fishermen. And that really doesn't seem to be the case. There's a lot of people out there all vying for a very small pot of money, and what's the secret, or what advice would you give to some guy who's really passionate about his hobby and really wants to try and make it into a career or at least make some money at it from sponsors and stuff? What's the key? What's their next course of action?
Well, if you're a young guy and you're still in school, stay at school. You know, get you a college degree. You know, that may sound, well, I can't wait that long. Yes, you can. A college degree is something that no one can ever take away from you. But what it looks good on a resume to a prospective sponsor, and it looks good for more than one reason. One reason it looks good on there, of course, naturally, it's a college degree. The other reason is it shows commitment. It shows that you started something and finished it. You had a commitment to finish that, and you did. And you did something, you know, you did something good. It will also help you in your profession if you go into bass fishing, if you get in marketing or promotions, because that's what you are. You're a promotioner. You promote and you market. That's what a professional bass fisherman does. The fishing is just a part of it. And the other thing you need to remember if you're going to start this is never think that the companies owe you something. They don't owe you anything. Just because you caught a little green fish somewhere doesn't mean anything. They don't owe you anything. You're going after a sponsor. You're going after that sponsor to prove to him that you can help him with their sales. You're going to have to show them that you can help them sell more of their product. You can promote their product and market their product maybe in a different way, or present it to another group of people that they haven't probably presented it to. But that's what your goal should be, not sitting back on your heels and thinking, well, I won a tournament, so they're going to come to me. You know, they owe me this because I did. That's the wrong thing. That's the most opposite thought you need to have in your brain there. But you need to go out with the thought that you're going to approach these companies and show them how you can improve their sales or improve their company through your fishing and through your promotion and marketing. And then in return, you might get some compensation from them in return for the promotion and marketing to enhance your fishing career. That's what you need to keep in mind. And don't be afraid to knock on doors. It's almost like a salesman's job. You know, you need to knock on doors, and yes, some people are going to tell you no. You know, don't take it personally. Just go, okay, then what, you know, you analyze in your own mind, say, maybe what did I do wrong with my approach here, and you change your approach and go to the next one. Somebody will say yes, but you got to have perseverance, and you got to present yourself professionally, and you got to have a good resume, and you got to have a good head on your shoulders as far as what you're going to say to them. You got to speak well. Because remember, you're going to be the first-line guy for this company. You're going to be what the public sees first. So you need to present yourself in the manner that this company would like to see their company presented to the consumer. Because that's what you are. It's the first line of their presentation of the product. And if you keep that thought in mind when you're pursuing these people and keep your stats together, and you know, when you do a resume, don't do a 100-page deal. That's not what they want to see. These people see resumes all the time. They're used to all these resumes. keep your resume fairly short and keep the important facts on there. Give them one or two articles maybe, and give them maybe a plan of what you want to do with their company and what you, how you can help their product sales, and keep it short to around 3, 4, or 5 pages. And that way they'll have time where they can read it instead of just looking at it and saying, man, it's too long to read and throw it in the trash, and make it presentable. And then, you know, that's what you need to do. But never, never assume that they owe you anything.
So the bottom line is it's like they're hiring you as an employee, and the position that they're really hiring you for is a sales position.
That's almost exactly what it is. It's almost exactly what it is. And to be a young guy coming out of college now in this, and wanting to get in this profession is awesome, because this profession has really exploded. There's lots of golden opportunities. We've got a lot of corporations now involved in fishing and looking at fishing in a way they have never looked at it before. And it's due simply to increased exposure, you know, with ESPN buying BASS and with Irwin really promoting FLW and Walmart involved. Man, there's a whole world of opportunity out there. You've got a lot of people now involved in this sport that's got a lot of money, and they're not afraid to spend it. They're trying to enhance it even more each year, getting more and more TV time with it, and that's just going to open the doors for more opportunities. But, you know, you have to approach it, just like you said, as trying to get employed. But that's what you're going to try to do. You're trying to get a job. And you don't go trying to find a job thinking, well, you owe me this because, I bought your product once or something like that. There's a lot of these companies, especially the fishing companies themselves, the direct fishing industry companies, that are really kind of saturated as far as sponsorship's concerned, and they have a limited supply of money. And where a young guy really needs to concentrate maybe on approaching sponsors is get something out of the industry. A lot of these corporations involved now, out-of-the-industry corporations, are really the guys to go after, the people that sell maybe snack foods, or they sell anything for that matter. You know, we've got Land O'Lakes and stuff like that, these companies involved, but there's other companies out there that can become involved if somebody would just approach them at it. So I think that's where a guy needs to concentrate more.
Okay, so you're a young guy, and, you know, everybody, all the big fishing industry folks know who Rick Klun is, and they know that if they give him some money or get him on their team, they're going to get a lot of benefit from it. But here I am. I'm Dave Johnson. I'm new to the deal. What kind of things can I come in and ask a company for? You and I talked a little while ago about maybe getting outside of the industry. And how do you go and approach somebody who's not in the fishing industry and sell them on the fishing industry? What kind of information do you take to them?
Well, first thing you need to do, one of the things you need to do is get you some demographic studies. You know, and these are available from a number of places, and BASS can help you with that, BASS can help you with that, or just get online on the computer and find some of this information. But get some demographic studies of how many fishermen there are, how many fishing licenses are sold in certain states, wherever the state you're from or whatever. And that right there will put an instant number on the amount of people to be exposed to this product. You know, that's just one thing you can do. You take that information into a prospective sponsor. You know, you take that information and say, hey, I can help you get into market in front of this number of consumers go directly to my fishing. And then you might want to involve maybe some kids somewhere. You know, corporations always like to see some kids involvement. If you can say, well, I've got this class at a school that I'm involved with, and I'd like to promote this through fishing, and if you can, you know, use some of your product to promote their product as well as is this, well, they might be interested in that. But, you know, if the out-of-industry sponsors are maybe be the ones to really target, because the inside the industry sponsors, all your lure companies, reel companies, boat companies, motor companies, we all have to have them, of course, but they are really saturated as far as sponsorships and pro fishermen. So if you can find something out of the industry and approach them, one of my best success stories as far as that's concerned is a Mountain Valley Springwater. Mountain Valley Springwater is a water company here in Hot Springs, where I live, and I approached them. It's been quite a few years back now. When I first approached them, they had no idea what I was talking about as far as fishing tournaments. They thought a fisherman was a guy that got here and got an ice chest full of beer and went out here and went fishing. That was about it. So, you know, I had to do some education here. So I tried to get some demographic studies, how many fishermen there were. Then I found to let them know that in no certain terms was alcohol served at these tournaments or allowed in the boats at all, and most fishermen, they drank water. Well, they sounded kind of interested in that. And we were cruising along there. We were just getting some water products, you know, for a sponsorship, and I was trying to get them to be a money sponsor. And finally, I got with this one rep at the area, one area rep, and we came up with this idea. He wanted to run a contest with one of his distributors. And he said they set up a contest in this distributorship that the salesman that got the most new accounts in a certain time frame won a fishing trip. And this was the distributor was up in the Illinois area, and they won a fishing trip down here in Hot Springs with me. So during that time period, they came to find out the guys that won and all the salesmen of that distributorship generated almost 300% more new business in response to this contest.
Just to go fishing with you?
Just to go fishing with me. And that really kind of got their attention then. From then on, they've been a great money sponsor for me. But they found out that fishermen drink a lot of water. And since then, we've got them on TV, on BASS tournaments. If you look on the BASS Bassmasters and weigh-in stands, you'll often see a bottle of Mountain Valley water sitting on the side. When Ray Scott was with them, he would always, every time I come across a weigh-in stand, he would do a little short commercial. I've got the reputation of being the water boy, water man. Because I hand out, one of my things before Mountain Valley is I hand out water at registration. Everybody comes through registration gets a bottle of Mountain Valley water. That's a relatively small expense for them, but it gets their product in the hands of the direct consumer and people that buy this water. And so next time they go to buy water, they're going to think of Mountain Valley. And it really has helped in that response. And if you can come up with something like that to a prospective sponsor that's out of the industry in order to promote their product like that, it's almost a sure thing they're gonna approach you on a sponsorship basis.
Okay, we've got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll have a tip of the week from Mike Worm.
Jameson Marine.
Jameson Marine has been selling bass boats for over 14 years. Jameson Marine is your number one connection for Triton bass boats in New York State. Triton also builds great blue water offshore fishing boats. See the all-new model 2300 walk-around cuddy on display at Jameson Marine. Take 390 South to I-86 East. Jameson Marine is conveniently located right at exit 41.
Boating made easy. That's Jameson Marine.
Okay, we're back with Mike Worm, and he's going to give us our tip of the week.
Okay, next time you're fishing down a bank here and you got a bunch of laydowns, instead of going down through there and throwing your usual thing like you throw, which is probably either a jig, a worm, or a spinnerbait, throw a crankbait down through those laydown trees. Number one, very few people do that because they're afraid of getting hung up. But don't be afraid of getting hung up because you're only fishing laydown trees are probably only 4 or 5 foot deep max, easily reachable with any rod, and you can get them unhung very easily. Number two, the fish haven't seen that in that situation, in that cover, and they will react better to it than they would a worm or a spinnerbait or something of that nature. And number three, you can present that lure in a completely different action in several different kinds of color combinations that they haven't seen previously. So next time you're out there on that water and if somebody goes down in front of you on a bank, don't be afraid to go behind them and throw a crankbait in those laydown moths. It will produce a lot of numbers of fish for you and lots of times will produce a larger fish for you.
Mike, thanks a lot for being on the show. We really appreciate your time, and we'll have you on any time if you got a message you want to get out.
Okay, sir. I appreciate it.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of BassProRadio.com. Remember, if you miss any part of the show, you can go to our website at www.BassProRadio.com to hear what you might have missed. Remember to click on the Enter Contest button when you get to our site and fill out the survey. If you know the secret word from this week's show is topwater, it'll put you into a drawing for a $25 tackle pack. I want to thank everyone for listening this week, and a special thanks go out to our sponsors and to my son Pete for doing a great job on his guitar on all our show music. This is Dave Johnson, and I will see you here again next week with another interesting interview with one of the leaders in this great sport of bass fishing. Please remember to wear your life jacket, be safe, and catch a big one.